I want you tonight to open your Bibles to Psalm 19. Just want to look at the first verse to introduce what we're going to talk about. And let me apologize for this study now. Okay? This will be different than any Bible study I've ever taught. It'll have a minimum amount of Bible. You know the scripture when Jesus said you need to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength? Well, tonight you need to love him with all your mind. I'm going to talk quite a bit about science tonight. And so bear with me. Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. That's what we're going to talk about. Tonight I want to talk about that I believe in creation. And I want to believe in creation in the sense of the macro, the creation of the universe. And one of the things that's often been done in Christian circles that I think is not a very good idea, but I think sometimes Christians view science as the enemy of Christianity. Science is our enemy. And it's really not really good science. If you think about it, God has revealed himself in three ways. He's revealed himself in his word, he's revealed himself in his son, and he's revealed himself in his creation. And so God reveals himself. So if science is studying the creation of God in an enlightening way, it reveals God. And I think you'll be able to see what I mean as I go on this evening. When you think of the universe, the person who is probably most responsible, although a lot of people thought this, for a view of the universe was Immanuel Kant, who is the great German philosopher. And Kant was the guy that articulated that the universe is eternal and static. In other words, the universe has always been here. It's an eternal universe, and it's static. It's always the same. And that really sort of won the day of all the scientists out of the scientific world. Everybody loved that. They thought that was the way things were to be viewed. And then in 1916, Albert Einstein showed up. And that really changed everything. Einstein, as a physicist, came up with the theory of relativity. And as Einstein was doing his mathematical computations, the word that he uses as he was working toward the theory of relativity was, "This is very irritating. I don't like what's happening." Einstein knew something mathematically. He knew that the universe had a beginning. He knew it did. And now he has the math to back it up. And he doesn't like that idea. It flies right in the face of science, he says. And so Einstein did, as strange as it sounds, in his mathematical computations, he put in a fudge factor. He tampered with the numbers a little so that science couldn't conclude what he knew was true. And that's an interesting thing for him to do. It didn't last very long, by the way. In 1922, a Russian mathematician, Alexander Friedman, exposed the fudge factor in his computations. And when Einstein did it, he was backed up by a British astronomer, cosmologist, named Arthur Eddington. And in 1919, Eddington said, "Philosophically, the notion of a beginning of the present order of nature is repugnant to me. And boy, do I wish I could find a loophole." Now, these are the best minds, Einstein, the best mind maybe in the world. You know, these are great minds. But I want you to see something. They're reluctant. They don't want this to be the case. They want a static, eternal universe. That's what they really want. But they don't have a choice on the basis of what they found. And then Einstein decided, in the 1920s, he went to Mount Wilson in California. And that's where the Hubble telescope was. And so he got to look, in a sense, at, out of the Hubble telescope at the universe. And he was especially interested in some of the galaxies. And he noticed, from his point of view, variations of a red color in the light spectrum. And he knew what that meant. He knew that that meant they were moving and moving away and moving fast. That's his conclusion. He knew that because he actually saw that on the telescope. So Einstein then says, after that moment, he said this, "Now I want to know how God created the world." He said, "I'm not interested in this or that phenomena, in the spectrum of this or that element. I want to know God's thought. I want to know the real details." So Einstein starts, and Einstein was pretty much, up till then, if there was a God, it was a pantheist. At that stage, he sort of thought the whole universe must be God, that type of thing, but he gave up on that eventually. So when you think about it, that's when this whole thing sort of got going. And since then, from a science point of view, it's become irrefutable. There's no question. The universe had a beginning. There's no scientist worth his weight in salt would ever say there's not. That's amazing. Now, they'll debate a little bit about the cause of it. We'll talk about that in a moment. The very first law of physics is the law of causality. Everything has a cause. You know, we know that. I mean, everything that has a beginning has a cause. So the universe had a beginning. So the universe had a cause. I mean, it's just simple syllogism. The idea behind it is now they know, in that sense, that the universe has a cause. So what they ended up coming up with is what we call surge, S-U-R-G-E. And that's the explanation of the universe as they see it. And each one of these steps sort of reveals something a little bit different about the universe. The first one, the S, is for the second law of thermodynamics, sometimes called entropy. And the second law of thermodynamics is the universe is running out of energy. Okay, they can measure that, and they know that. It's running out of energy. Our sun is about 40% of its energy has been used. It has about 60 more percent to go. But the whole universe is running out of energy. Now, you might have heard someone say this. They said at one time, well, the universe expands and then contracts. And then expands and then contracts. No one says that now. All right. First of all, the amount of energy lost in that would have been, because remember, if it did this for infinity and it loses so much energy every time it does it, there would be no universe. Okay? Because the whole idea is you continue to lose energy. And if you lost energy forever, remember, we're talking eternity, forever, there wouldn't be a universe now. So that doesn't work anymore. Most of the arguments that scientists use or college professors use is what I call the bear argument. Okay? It's a dumb joke, but it really makes the point. You know, two guys are, you know, walking in the woods together, you know, in Alaska, and all of a sudden a big grizzly bear comes out in the path and stands up and roars at him. And the one guy says to the other guy, "We got to run." And the guy says, "Well, we can't outrun the bear." And he said, "I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you." That's the argument. That's what you see a lot on college campuses and places like that. I don't have to outrun the bear. I can outrun you. I can get some students in here, and I can hypothesize all kinds of things to them. All I have to be is a little smarter than they are, you know, the way this works. And so that's what you find in a lot of these arguments that are made. I mean, and some of them are made by brilliant people. I read an argument this last week from Stephen Hawking that was as nonsensical and goofball as anything I've ever read. Oh, Hawking's a genius. He's a genius. He made stuff up that was just unbelievable from a scientific point of view in order to try to explain something. It's just amazing how this works. So the second law of thermodynamics is that, the law of entropy, is that everything falls apart in time. Everything. Everything in the universe falls apart in time. Everything in the world falls apart in time. Your house falls apart in time. Your car falls apart in time. And look at you guys. You're falling apart in time. Everything falls apart in time. That's just the second law of thermodynamics. No one can argue with that. And Eddington, the great British astronomer, said, the law of entropy increases. The second law of thermodynamics holds. I think the supreme position among all the laws of nature, if someone points out to you that your pet theory of the universe is in disagreement with, say, Maxwell's equations, well, then so much for Maxwell. If it's found to be contradicted by observation, well, these experiments do bungle things sometimes. But if your theory is found to be against the second law of thermodynamics, I can give you absolutely no hope. There is nothing, he said, for it but the deepest humiliation for you. No one can argue about the second law of thermodynamics. And the idea of it is simply this, that you know that things are falling apart, so they had to start at a certain position. There had to be a start. If things are falling apart, they had to start sometime. Otherwise, if it was eternity, what? They'd have all fallen apart. You see, there would be no energy in the universe. If there wasn't a beginning, there would be no energy. You can't have energy. If we're losing energy now, and we were losing energy forever, then you have no energy by now. In fact, you would have had no energy for a long time ago, because I don't know how, if it's forever, it would have happened a long, long time ago. The second thing is the U in surge, and that is the universe is expanding. And that's had a really unique effect on astrophysicists. The universe is expanding rapidly. I mean, it's expanding. It's expanding at the outermost points of the universe faster than it's expanding in the innermost points. It's constantly expanding, the universe is. Now, that made astrophysicists understand something. If it's expanding, and it's expanding in all directions, so it's expanding this way, that way, that way, and that way. It's expanding in all directions. What does that tell us from the Big Bang? You have to start coming back, right? If I'm going that way, I have to start bringing it back. This way, bring it back. And you bring it back to a point, right? That's what you do. Now, here's what they understand. This is their point of view, not ours. I mean, it is ours, but we didn't say it. They did. What does it eventually come back to? Astrophysicists say what it comes back to is not a solid sphere the size of a galaxy. It doesn't come back to something the size of a star. It doesn't come back to something the size of the Earth. It doesn't come back to something the size of a basketball. It doesn't come back to something the size of a ping pong ball. It comes back to nothing. It has to come back to nothing. Nothing. You see, absolutely nothing. And that's all. That's not only what we see in material, that's all space and all time. It comes back to nothing. The best definition I've read on nothing is Aristotle's. Aristotle said that nothing is what rocks dream about. Okay, that's nothing. You see, and that's what it's, so they know that now. They know that it came back to nothing. So they know that it was just spoken into existence. They know that it happened instantly. And that's their thoughts. That's not ours. And these people writing these down aren't theists. They're not Jews or Christians or Muslims. They're just people doing the science. That's the way they see it. One of them said there was no matter before the Big Bang. In fact, chronologically, there was no before the Big Bang because there were no befores without time. And there was no time before the Big Bang. I mean, they get it. They understand this, probably better than most of us do, because they understand the physics of it. Now, the R stands for radiation from the Big Bang. And this is kind of a strange thing, but there has to be some record in the universe if there was a Big Bang. It's called radiation. 1965, two scientists working, I believe, at the Bell Labs in New Jersey started getting a reading off their antennae. Their names are Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson. And at first they thought that the readings they were getting was coming from pigeon droppings on their antenna. So they had to check out their antennas to make sure there weren't pigeon droppings. There weren't any. And so they stumbled upon something that won them the Nobel Peace Prize. in 1965. And what they found out was that there is a cosmic radiation or an afterglow that is actually light and heat from the initial explosion in the universe. The light can't be seen any longer because of the wavelength of the light. It's a little bit, I think I read, a little bit shorter than those produced by a microwave oven. But the heat can be detected. And they found it. And they won the Nobel Peace Prize for it. And so what ended up happening is now they know, you see, there was a big bang, so to speak, something created out of nothing. Agnostic astronomer, who's probably in his time, the most foreknown astronomer in the world, Robert Jastrow. This is what he said, and he's an agnostic guy, but he says this: no explanation other than the Big Bang has been found for the fireball radiation. The clincher, which convinced and almost always to the last doubting Thomas, is that the radiation discovered by Penzias and Wilson has exactly the pattern of wavelengths expected for the light and heat produced by a great explosion. Supporters of the steady state theory, he said, have tried desperately to find an alternative explanation, but they have completely failed. At the present time, the Big Bang has no competitors in the field of astronomy. So these are their words, not ours. The next one's a little bit tougher, but I'll just try to explain it. It's called the Great Galaxy Seeds. And if the Big Bang actually occurred, scientists believe that we should see slight variations or ripples in the temperature of the cosmic background that was found by Penzias and Wilson. And in 1989, they did. NASA sent up a $200 million satellite and tried it with really sensitive instruments and said they want to see if those ripples are there. They were there. Precise and exactly the way the mathematicians said they would have to be there. This is kind of an interesting thing. George Smoot, who headed the NASA COBE, it's called COBE, the Cosmic Background Explorer. George Smoot was the man who headed up the project, and he said this. Here was his quote after it: if you're religious, it's like looking at God, which is really an interesting thing for a scientist to say. If you're religious, it's just like looking at God, because you see what this works like. University of Chicago astrophysicist Michael Turner said this: the significance of this discovery not only found ripples, but scientists were amazed at their precision. The ripples show that the explosion and expansion of the universe was precisely tweaked to cause just enough matter to congregate to allow galaxy formation, but not enough to cause the universe to collapse back on itself. Now, this part's the part I want you to come away with tonight. The scientists are figuring out the universe is perfect. Anything else other than it can't exist. You see, if it didn't have the accelerant that it has, gravity would take place and it would collapse back on itself. But it doesn't. It's always expanding. It's continuing to expand. He called these ripples, Smoot did, the machining marks from the creation of the universe. This clearly shows me the fingerprints of the Maker. Now, what I want to see, these aren't Christian apologists. These are top scientists, okay? These are the people who, you know, don't even like what they're finding from their point of view. That bothers them. These seeds that they find, these ripple effects, are the largest thing known in the known universe. They're the largest structures ever detected. The biggest one extends one-third across the known universe. That's 10 billion light years, or 60 billion trillion. That'd be the number 60 followed by 21 zeros. That's how big it is. They found it. They looked at it. And, of course, the E is Einstein's theory of relativity. Okay, the Big Bang is undisputed from an astronomy point of view. Nobody disagrees with it. They all believe it's true. They all believe that something came from nothing. They all believe that now. You see, so it's not like, oh, we believe something very odd or very strange. The next question it comes down to is, what does that do as the question for God's existence? You see, that becomes a very important aspect of it. And Jastrow, who is the founder of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies, he was America's top astronomer. He wrote a book called God and the Astronomers. Now remember, he's an agnostic guy, but he wrote a book called God and the Astronomers. And one of the things he says in chapter one I find interesting, he says, when an astronomer writes about God, his colleagues assume he's either over the hill or he's going bonkers. He said, in my case, it should be understood from the start that I'm agnostic on all religious matters. He said, but I'm writing about it. You see, that's what he ends up saying. He said, look, the details differ, but the essential elements in the astronomical and biblical accounts in Genesis are exactly the same. I think that's a fascinating thing for him to say. He said, the chain of events leading to man commenced suddenly and sharply at a definite moment in time, at a flash of light and energy. So that's kind of interesting. He also says, astronomers now find themselves painted in a corner because they have proven by their own methods that the world began abruptly in an act of creation to which you can trace the seeds of every star, every planet, every living thing in the cosmos and on the earth. And they found that all this happened as a product of forces they cannot even hope to discover, that there are what I or anyone would call supernatural forces at work is now, I think, a scientifically proven fact. So, kind of interesting in light of what some people would want to tell you. Science writer Fred Herene says, certainly there was something that set it all off. Certainly, if you're religious, I can't think of a better theory of the origin of the universe than that you find in Genesis. Kind of interesting from their point of view. Jastrow says that the problem that we have in science is they never want to talk about it. We'll see this next week when I deal in the micro and deal with evolution. But they don't want to talk about it because of their own colleagues or biases. Jastrow says theologians, well, I could tell you this before this. Jastrow said something I thought was funny. I didn't write it down. He said, for hundreds of years now, scientists have been climbing a mountain as astronomers, as astrophysicists. And he said, and we fought hard to get there against all conditions. And he said, when we finally put our hand up on the ledge and swung our leg up to be on the top, the theologians were sitting there. And I thought that was funny, you know. He said, we spent all this time climbing, and there they were already from a different perspective. He said that theologians generally are delighted with the proof of the universe had a beginning, but astronomers are curiously upset by it. Their reactions provide an interesting demonstration of the response of the scientific mind, supposedly a very objective mind, when evidence uncovered by science itself leads to a conflict with the articles of faith in our profession. It turns out that scientists behaves the way the rest of us do when our beliefs are in conflict with the evidence. We become irritated, we pretend that the conflict does not exist, or we paper over it with meaningless phrases. He said, all scientists know this, and they don't want to say they know it. They don't want to believe they know it. They know what the facts are, he said, but they don't want to admit it. They just don't want to say it. Sort of like we are, the same kind of bias. Don't confuse me with the facts. I know what I think. The funniest thing I read this week is George Will, who I really like. He thought about it in a different way. George Will said, soon the American Civil Liberties Union, or the People of the American Way, or some similar faction from the secular left will file a suit against NASA, charging that the Hubble Space Telescope unconstitutionally gives comfort to the religiously inclined. I think that's probably true. We got to make sure that's not the case. The scientists came up with a list of things that they believe, what could have caused this? What kind of entity or being? And this is their description. One that is self-existent, timeless, non-spatial, and immaterial. Since the first cause created time, space, and matter, the first cause must be outside of time, space, and matter. In other words, it must be without limits or infinite. It must be unimaginably powerful to be create a tower universe out of nothing. It must be supremely intelligent to design a universe with such incredible precision to have the universe exist. And it must be personal in order to choose to convert a state of nothingness into time, space, material in a universe. And actually, an impersonal force has no ability to make these kind of choices. Like, their description is basically about the same as what David gives you in Psalms. That type of thing. So, let me move on then. The uniqueness of the design of the universe is a very important thing to understand. It's amazing. The Earth is even more amazing. But These are called the anthropic constants in science. The anthropic constant, one, is the oxygen level, okay? And so what you end up having here, think about the Earth. The oxygen level in the Earth, if the oxygen level in the Earth is 21%, do you know that? It's 21%. Now, depending on which scientist you read, it could go to 22 or 23. If it was 22 or 23%, that's a small percentage point, oxygen, fires would automatically combust all over the world. It'd burn the world down. Their fires would be automatic. They would just commence on their own with 22 to 23% instead of 21. And by the way, if there was less than 21, especially 19, 18 in that range, human beings would suffocate and die. So the oxygen in the Earth has to be exactly what it is for us to have life here. The anthropic constant, too, is the atmospheric transparency of the Earth, the way the atmosphere works around the Earth. That's what we're talking about. If the atmosphere were less transparent than it is, not enough solar radiation would reach the Earth, and all life would die. Now, if it were more transparent than it would, we'd be bombarded with too much solar radiation and would all die. But it's exactly the way it ought to be. Okay? Now, I'm just getting beginning. This is unbelievable how far this goes. The Moon-Earth gravitational interaction. If the interaction between the Moon has to be exactly where it is and exactly the size it is. It says if the Moon interaction were greater than it is now, tidal effects on the oceans and the atmosphere in the rotational period would be too severe for life to exist on Earth. If it were less, orbital changes would cause climatic instabilities. In either event, life on Earth would be impossible. Gravity. The gravity that is pulling, the gravity that we have on Earth. Now, this is amazing. If it were altered, now bear with me, 0.000000038 zeros. 0.038 zeros, one. If it were altered by that much, no life would be on Earth. That's amazing. What a coincidence of time and chance, how this all works out. The extent of this anthropic principle is one of the most amazing and probable arguments for the existence of God when it created. And that's what the scientists are finding out. It's too perfect. It's perfect beyond our imagination. Perfect. There are more than 100 of these principles. As a matter of fact, Hugh Ross says there's 122 of them. And he writes about it in his book. 122 principles that have to be perfect for there to be life on Earth. Simultaneously perfect. I'll give you a few of them. If the centrifugal force of planetary movements did not precisely balance the gravitational forces, nothing could be held in orbit around the sun. So we wouldn't have orbits around the sun. If the universe had expanded at the rate 1 millionth more slowly than it did, 1 millionth, if the universe expanded 1 millionth more slowly than it did, expansion would have stopped, the universe would have collapsed on itself and all, before any stars had formed. And it says, and if it had happened, if it had expanded faster, no galaxies would have ever been formed in the universe. 1 millionth of 1%. Any of the laws of physics can be described as a function of the velocity of light, which is now 299,792,458 meters per second. Even a slight variation in the speed of light would alter the other constants and preclude any possibility of life on Earth if light didn't move exactly at the speed it does. These are just astrophysicists doing the calculations. If the water vapor levels in the atmosphere were greater than they are now, a runaway greenhouse effect would cause the temperatures to rise too high for human use. If it was less, insufficient greenhouse effect would make the Earth so cold, no plant life and humans wouldn't live. This one's interesting. If Jupiter were not in its current orbit, Earth would have been bombarded with space material. Jupiter's gravitational fields act as a cosmic vacuum cleaner, attracting asteroids and comets that might otherwise strike the Earth. You never think, it has to be that big, where it's at, and to protect the Earth. If the thickness of the Earth's crust were greater, Too much oxygen would be transferred to the crust and no life would exist. If it were thinner, volcanic and tectonic activity would make life impossible on Earth. It just goes, this just goes, I'm going to give you 10, there's 122. If the rotation of the Earth took longer than 24 hours, temperature differences would be too great between night and day. If the rotation period were shorter, atmospheric and wind velocities would be too great for us. The 23-degree tilt of the Earth's axis is just right. If the tilt were altered slightly, surface temperatures would be too extreme on Earth. It has to be tilted exactly the way it is. If the atmospheric discharge lightning rate were greater, there'd be too much fire and destruction on Earth. If it were less, there'd be no nitrogen in the soil for green plants to grow. The amount of lightning has got to be balanced perfectly. If there were more seismic activity, more life would be lost. If there were less, nutrients of the ocean floors and the river runoff would not be cycled back to the continents through tectonic uplift, and the Earth would go through massive changes. Ross says that there's 122 of these. And so he said, let me give you some idea of mathematical and this is a little bit hard to figure, so just bear with me. He said that let's assume that there are 1,022. Now, he doesn't mean 1,022. He means one with 22 zeros. Okay, one with 22 zeros. That's a big number. He said, let's assume. Now, I think he's playing with Carl Sagan here. Remember Carl Sagan? There's nothing but the cosmos. It's always been here and always will be here. Now that's true, you know. And there are billions and billions of Earths and billions of people. None of it's true. But he said, I'll give the number, 1,000 with 22 zeros. He said, that's the highest estimate he ever saw, the amount of planets that could exist in the universe. 1,000 with 22 zeros. That's a lot of planets. That's way beyond trillions, quadrillions. It's way, way beyond that. He said, if that's true, what would be the chance that there would be life on another planet? He said, the chance would be one in 138 zeros. Now, he said, if there were one in 22 zeros planet, the odds of having 122 things happen in any one of those planets is one. And then again, the number, that's why the 138 zeros. That's the odds. Now, that's based on 122 perfections that make Earth life on Earth possible. He said, now, you please have to understand it. Astrophysicists think that there's one with 78 zeros. That tells you, I'll give you a sense of how big the number is. One with 78 zeros, atoms in the universe. Atoms. Now, that gives you an idea. In the universe, one in 78, with 78, that's how many atoms. Think how many atoms are in your body. Atoms. He said there's one in 78, with 78 zeros. That's how many atoms they estimate are in the universe, the material universe. So, in a sense, the odds are 10 times greater than the number of atoms in the universe. Atoms, and there'd be life somewhere else. He said, you see, and that's not what we see. We hear all the time. It's all over the place. You know, one of the best ones I always love is that the aliens did this. You know, and there's always someone in the History Channel telling you the aliens did this. You know, aliens brought us life. That it wasn't created. Aliens brought it. By the way, how dumb is that argument about life? Okay, say the aliens brought it. Okay, let's just assume that. So where did the aliens come from? No, some alien brought their life to them. Okay. Then where'd they come from? You see, you can see how this works. It just goes on and on and on and on. Cosmologist Ed Harrison says this. He uses the word proof. He says, when I look at the universe and the Earth the way it is, here is the cosmological proof of the existence of God. The design argument of Paley, updated and refurbished. The fine-tuning of the universe provides a prima facie evidence of deistic design. That's his conclusion. Arnold Penzias, the Nobel laureate, said, astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing and delicately balanced to provide exactly the conditions required to support life. In the absence of an absurdity improbable accident, the observations of modern science seem to suggest with as clearly as possible there is a supernatural plan. Now, the reason this argument is so powerful is that's where it always starts. You see, the whole idea, the whole argument with an agnostic or an atheist is, well, I don't believe there is a God. And now you can go back to the idea, well, how did it all begin? You see, and no matter what their argument is, it's wrong. And it's been proven wrong by science. So they can't say, well, it just began on its own. They can say that, although remember, they don't have to outrun the bear. They just have to outrun you. Well, my brother-in-law said that, and I didn't know what to say, you know, to that. But it didn't. You see, it didn't. We know it didn't. We know how unbelievable, we know it's a single event, and we know how unbelievably complicated it is, the design of it. And even causing scientists who don't want to come to these conclusions that this has been designed. This has a very specific design to it, making it a very different kind of thing from our point of view. Now, the other thing we often talk about is this whole idea of how we can travel. You know, I like Star Trek. I like, because if you can go like warp 9, you see, that warp 9 is not 9 times the speed of light, by the way. Warp 1 is, you break the barrier of the speed of light. Warp 2 is twice as fast as warp 1. Warp 3 is twice as fast as warp 2. Warp 4 is twice as fast. See, they figure we need to have a way to move. You know, we can really move with these. Now, you know, and by the way, all of it's driven by the warp drive. Now, they never told you what the warp drive is. It's just something that makes it go really fast and go around the universe the way it is. It doesn't work like that. If the Earth were if the sun was the size of a ping pong ball, that's the sun. The Earth would be the size of a single grain of sand. That'd be the Earth. Ping pong ball, sun, Earth, the size of a grain of sand. The orbit of the Earth around the sun would be 10 feet out. So 10 feet from the ping pong ball, the grain of sand's going around the sun. Pluto would be out there about 120 yards, furthest part of our solar system. That's about 120 yards going around there, okay? The closest star that exists to us, now remember, the sun's only the size of a ping pong ball, is Alpha Centauri, 4.5 light years away. Alpha Centauri would be 500 miles away. That's the sun's the size of a ping pong ball. It'd be 500 miles to the nearest star in our galaxy. The nearest galaxy to ours is Andromeda. That's the closest galaxy to the Milky Way galaxy. It would be 350 million miles away if the sun were the size of a ping pong ball. That's the next closest galaxy to our galaxy, 350 million miles away. On the basis of how we understand propulsion in space right now, the fastest we believe we can go. We don't believe we can exceed the speed of light. By the way, if you exceed the speed of light, what happens? Well, we don't know. No one's ever done that. But what theoretically, what happens? You go back in time. You see, that's part of the dimension. Remember, that's what Einstein said. If you think about it, if there's a clock on the back wall and it says right now it's 17 minutes to 8, and I start moving from and I can see that because of what? Light. The light from the clock's coming to my eyes, and I say it's 17 minutes to 8. Now, what if I was moving at the same speed the light was coming toward me, and I'm moving that way? What would I see the clock at? It would stay at 17 minutes to 8. It just stays there. Because the light coming from it can't catch me because I'm going the same speed the light is. That's the speed of light. So the whole idea that we can exceed it, that's theoretically probably not even possible. But the fastest way we think it could happen to us, if we were to set out theoretically the best we could to just try to visit Alpha Centauri, the best we think we could possibly do is it would take at least 250 years to get to Alpha Centauri, the nearest star. So the idea that, oh, we can explore all the galaxies and all the, it's not, we can't. And by the way, not only is it a 250 year, but with all of the space dust and all the things that could happen at high speed to your ship, the chances of you making it very far are very, very slim. You know, so it doesn't really necessarily work that way at all. So, the universe is unique. Started in a Big Bang, it's uniquely designed. It's infinitely bigger than we ever thought it was. Remember, in the scriptural days, they thought the earth was flat, center of the universe. The universe was a canopy on top of the earth. The sun and moon moved on it, and the stars sort of moved this way on it. It was all right above us. Now we know that's just not even close. I mean, it's so expansive, it's so big. I mean, have you ever thought of this? Do you have any of you have a star named after you? You can do that. Go online. You can do that. Like $49. You can have a star named after you. Now, remember, how many stars are there? Well, there's billions of stars in our galaxy, and there are billions and billions of galaxies. So you can have a star named after you. Now, that seems kind of romantic, doesn't it? I mean, it's kind of cool. But now, what if I said to you, because this is what astronomers have said, what if I said to you for $49.95, I'll name a grain of sand at one of the beaches in the world after you? Because scientists believe that the number of grains of sand that are on all the Earth is about the same number of stars in the universe. So I could tell you, over in Destin, you just go in that, there's a grain of sand named after you. See, you would see that was a hoax, but the universe is so big, you think you're getting something really special because the idea is that they're going to name one of those stars after you. I'm not saying don't do it, I'm just saying think about it. Okay? Now, I want you to go with me to Colossians chapter 1. In verse 15, Paul starts talking about the uniqueness of Jesus Christ. He says in verse 16, by him all things were created, both in heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, thrones, dominions, rulers, authorities, all things were created by him and for him. The Son of God created everything in a physical and a spiritual world. And he's before all things. He has prominence over all things. Now, don't miss this next phrase. And in him, what's it say? At the end of verse 17. All things hold together. So how many things are held together by Christ? Now guess what astronomers have found? Dark matter. They say dark matter makes the universe what it is. Astronomers believe that 68 to 80% of all the universe is dark matter. Now if you ask an astronomer what a dark matter is, they say we have no idea. We can't measure it. We don't know what it is, but we know it's there. We know it makes all the laws of physics work. We know that it's essential for the universe to be there, but we don't know what it is. And I'm thinking, I think we know. You know, all things are held together by him. What do you mean held together? He holds it all together. I mean, it's an interesting thing. They don't know what dark matter is. You know, they have no idea what it is. They're trying to figure out what it is, but they know it's there. Because they know otherwise the universe couldn't exist the way that it does. It's an amazing, it's an amazing thing when you start thinking about the scope of this. And I want you to understand that. When they put the Hubble Space Telescope in orbit, it didn't go well the first 4 years. One of the, I don't know how they did it, but one of the lenses was not any good. One of the mirrors was no good, and they had to replace it. It took 4 years to get a replacement ready to take up. They took it up, and they replaced it. And they decided then, at that time, for the first time, because we didn't have an atmosphere, they decided to take one of the darkest places in the universe and just have the cameras of the space telescope look into that dark place. They thought that's, you know, just one square. You come away on a picture about this big. And they said they let the lens open for a long period of time so they could see if there's anything there. Now, up till then, they didn't know if there was anything there because from the telescopes we had on Earth, it just looked like a dark place in the universe. Well, when they looked at it, guess what they found? Hundreds and hundreds of galaxies in that one square, each with a billion stars, each moving. Like, what? That it ended up infinitely bigger than what they said. And see, not only is the material from the Big Bang moving out, but space is moving with it. This is an amazing thing. Now, why is this so vast? Go with me to Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. Now, what's interesting about this is that in Isaiah chapter 40, starting in verse 12, you see that God's talking about his creation and how unique it is. And he talks about how great he is and how small man is. In verse 21, he says, "Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the vault of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain. He spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. It is he," he said, "who reduces rulers to nothing, who makes the judges of the earth meaningless. Scarcely they have been planted, and scarcely they have been sown. Scarcely," he said, "has their stock taken root on the earth. But he merely blows on them, and they are withered, and the storm carries them," he said, "away like stubble." In other words, man's nothing like me. If you take the best of men, they're nothing to me. Mankind in and of itself is like grasshoppers to me, or grasshoppers to you. Man is nothing. He said, "I blow on them, they're gone." He said, that's who I am. Now watch what he says next. Verse 25. "To whom then will you liken me?" If you want to see, and what's the problem that we have? If I say to you, what's God like? You know what a lot of Christians tell me? He's just like us, except he's smarter than we are. And he's stronger than we are. He is so much not like us. I mean, it's incomprehensible how different it is. I mean, it's not like anything you and I can even imagine. He's not like that. Now, we aren't in his image. We're eternal beings. We have mind and intellect, but that doesn't make us like God. That's what God said. You're like grasshoppers. Look, the best of you, I just blow you away. You're not there anymore. That's what he says. Now watch. He said, "To whom then will you liken me, that I should be his equal, says the Holy One?" Now watch what he says. "Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars." He said, "The one who leads forth their host by number, he calls them all by name because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one of them is missing." God says, "You want to know what I'm like? Look at the universe. You want to know what I'm like? Look at the universe." And now we can. Mankind, look at the universe. And it's like, it's overwhelming. It's so vast. It's so unbelievable. God says, "Yeah, I made it like that." And you say, "Well, why would you make it? You don't have to make it that big." Yeah, I know. I want you to see me. You see, I want you to see me. That's what I'm like. That's what God is like. I can remember way back in 1980, I was at Dallas Seminary, and I was reading a guy who was writing a commentary on these verses. And I can't remember the author's name, but I was reading about it, and he was talking about this is how we understand who God is. You know, what God is like, his vastness. And he said, and please understand what I'm saying here. He said, everything we know in the known universe could be in a snow globe on God's desk. And I thought that was funny. Like, he didn't say it, but he's just like, you know, we're thinking, look, it's so vast, it's so big. And he goes, "Yeah, it's right here. I got it right here. Want to see it?" You know, it's just God. He's infinite, is what he's saying. And we're starting now, science is starting to understand how infinite the universe is. It's amazing. You know, that's the amazing thing about just the way God acts and how this thing works and how he acts upon it. It's an amazing thing. Now, I'm going to read a couple quotes, and I'm going to go to a couple verses here. These are things that scientists say. This is what Stephen Hawking says. Stephen Hawking says, "The odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous. I think clearly that there are religious implications whenever you start to discuss the origins of our universe." Now, Hawking never gets quoted by our media that way. He's always the ultimate atheist. He says something's on. He knows. You know. I mean, he said, Hawking tried to explain the universe with imaginary time and imaginary math. He said, before the universe was, there was imaginary time, not real time because it had to start somewhere, and imaginary math. And as the math formulas moved, imaginary, in enough, an imaginary time, they hit the formula right and the Big Bang occurred. That's one of the great minds of the world. And the astrophysicist just ripped it to shreds. I mean, it's not imaginary. What was he doing? He doesn't want to say there's a God. I don't want to believe that. No matter what, I don't want to say that there was a God who did this. Fred Hoyle says, a common sense interpretation of the fact suggests that a super intelligent being has monkeyed with the physics as well as the chemistry and the biology, and that there are no blind forces working, speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to be so overwhelming as to put my conclusion beyond any question. He said, there's nothing I can do. These are all secular. Physicists are running into stone walls of things that seem to reflect intelligence everywhere they look. They don't know what to do with that. The impression of design, Paul Davies, is overwhelming. The fine-tuning of the universe provides a prima facie evidence for deistic design. Take your choice. Blind chance, it requires multitudes of universes, or a design, it requires only one. That was Harrison. Richard Morse, he said, how it is that common elements such as carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen happen to have just the kind of atomic structure that they need to make molecules upon the life of which life on our planet depends. It's almost as though the universe has been consciously designed by someone else. I mean, that's all their conclusions. That's not ours. And I think that's a very important thing for us to understand. Now, look at with me to first to Isaiah 65. I'll have to go fast. Isaiah 65. Isaiah 65. God speaking ahead. Verse 17. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth. The former things shall not be remembered or come into mind. He said, that's what God says. He says, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem for rejoicing and her people for gladness. God says way back in Isaiah, 700 years before Christ, I'm going to create a new heaven and a new earth. Now, let's go to Revelation 21 for a moment. Revelation 21. And I just want to look at two verses and then talk about it for the next 5 minutes. Verse 4 says, he shall wipe away every tear from their eyes in death, and there shall no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. First things have passed away. He who sits on the throne says, behold, I am making what? All things new. New heaven, new earth. He said, I'm going to make all things new. What does that mean? You know, if you think about it for a minute, astrophysics point of view, what's a new Jerusalem look like? A cube, right? Some say a pyramid, but I think a cube. What's its dimensions? Come on, people. 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles, right? Okay, does that tell you anything from a science point of view? Nothing exists in the universe naturally of 300 miles or above that isn't spherical because of gravity. When something gets 300 miles in size, it turns into a circle. That's why the moon's a circle, we're a circle, the sun's a circle. Gravity pulls it into a circle on all equal sides. So what's that tell you about gravity in the new heaven, new earth? There isn't any. He's making all things new. The laws of gravity aren't going to work. That's not the way it works at all. In fact, some of the guys I read started talking about this. Not only is there no sickness, pain, suffering, and grief, he said, but it's not just that. He said, what you're going to end up finding is that there's no electromagnetic light. There are no shadows. There's no darkness. The sun and moon exist, it says, but the light comes from who? From God himself. There's no darkness, not ever. He said, so there's no electromagnetic energy. There's no gravity. There's no darkness. He said, that's because he's making all things new. It'll be extremely different. One of the things that he talks about that was interesting is that he says, we don't have any idea what this will be like, but he believes it'll be so different than what we think it's going to be like. That'll be overwhelming to us. Remember, it in a sense, are you when you go to be with the Lord, you're going to be there a long time. Is eternity a long time? Remember, time was created, right? So what did God do before the creation? You'll have to ask God this, by the way. I don't know this. But the point is, you say, well, that was an eternity. Eternity is the absence of time. Okay, the ramifications that are overwhelming, because we know something about the new heaven, new earth when you read the passages. Do we have sequence? Do we have cause and effect? Do we relate to people? Yes, but not in time. You see, time is something very different. That's a very different thing. One of the things that Ross said that I thought interesting, he said in the eternal state, we're not limited by time that way, just like Christ wasn't. One of the things I never thought about, he said, when Christ was physically ascended, when he physically ascended, he showed that in his being, gravity has no effect on him. Remember, he's a physical being. He ate with him. He just ascended. He didn't propel himself. The laws of gravity don't apply to me. None of the laws will apply to you or me either. He says that on earth, for example, God says that one of the most important things is the husband-wife relationship because it's a picture of the relationship God has with his people. And that's an amazing thing. He said, but in the eternal state, and that's why Jesus said we neither marry nor given in marriage, we're like the angels. He said, but remember, all of us are called the bride of Christ. And we'll all relate perfectly to him and to each other. And he says you won't have to worry about relating to people in sequence. I'm like, hey, did you see Velma anywhere? Did you see my wife anywhere? I've been looking for her for like a day and a half. I know, and I can't find her. Now, that might be true. She might be avoiding me. But the point of it is that he says, no, you can relate simultaneously. And it's like, wow, I never even thought of these kind of things. But the new heaven, notice, all things are new. Even the laws that we use now, the laws of physics, they're new. He said, this will all be different. This will be different than you can possibly imagine. It's going to be infinitely better, you know, for us. It's not just no more sorrow, no more tears, no more sin, no more struggle, no more darkness, no more gravity, no more. It's just different, you know. And so consequently, I'll end the whole thing by saying, look, I believe in creation. I believe the universe was created. And I think that science is not our enemy with this. They back it up. And I think when you talk to anybody who is atheistic or agnostic, that argument is always where you should go. You see, because if you have the best minds from Einstein on saying something supernatural caused all this. Now, that's up to them. They can be Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist. They can do it. They can be pantheist. They can do anything they want to do. But they can't say there is no God. There is no cause. See, I think the arguments they've always used before, well, the universe always existed. We know it didn't. You see, it pulsates. No, it doesn't. You see, we know that. Science has proven all those things to be false. You know, it's a different world than anyone imagines. And so I hope not to, you know, I try to stay away from something too technical. But, and by the way, if you really want to read about it, there's a lot out there to read if you're inclined to read on those levels. There's a lot out there. But we're not in the dark ages. We're not people who believe something really stupid while the world's going to be really smart. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for our discussion tonight. How infinite and great you are and how small and finite we are. Father, I thank you for our curiosity as people, because of our science and our curiosity, even those who didn't want to found out that you exist and that you spoke all this into existence in an instant. What an amazing thought. How overwhelming is that? Thank you, Father, for revealing yourself to us. In Christ's name, amen.